Journalist Faye Flam interviewed risk communication expert Peter M. Sandman on February 9, 2020, about the coronavirus pandemic to be, now officially known as COVID-19. This is the complete interview. For this interview, divided into six shorter segments, or other content on coronavirus risk communication, go to www.psandman.com.
The question of what you should be afraid of now and the question of what you should be worrying about vis-a-vis the short-term future and preparing for are completely different questions. And the answer, if you're in the United States and you haven't been to China in recent weeks and nobody you're in close contact with has been to China in recent weeks, the answer to the question, what should you be afraid of now, coronavirus is not on the list. The current risk to, the average American of coronavirus is negligible. I mean, it's not just be more afraid of flu, it's be more afraid of falling down the stairs, be more afraid of taking a bath. I mean,
there are millions of things more dangerous to you right now than coronavirus, but the most of those things are not getting, more dangerous day by day at a very fast and accelerating rate. Mm-hmm. And it looks like the coronavirus is. They're not sure of that, and it could burn itself out. It could, things could happen that would make it not something to be worried about. But right now, the people who are saying don't worry about coronavirus because it's not here now. I mean, they don't say that about measles. They don't say, they don't say that about retirement.
Yeah.
Worry is about the future.
Awesome.
And it just doesn't make any sense to tell people not to worry about something that is looming as a possible, very serious risk in the not very long term future. So, the big picture is, of course you shouldn't be worried. You shouldn't be afraid to go out the street because of coronavirus today. But it's perfectly appropriate to be thinking about, could this get worse? Is this likely to get worse? How would it get worse? And how would it affect my life if it did? I think that's very straightforward. The dominant two questions are, is this going to spread widely, and is it going to be severe, or how widely will it spread and how severe will it be, since those are not dichotomous questions. And the experts think they know the answer to the first. They're not certain, but they think they know the answer to the first, and they really, really don't know the answer to the second.
The second being how severe the disease will be for individuals.
How severe it will be. Virtually all the experts are guessing is too weak, but certain would be too strong. They are betting that it will probably be pandemic. Mm-hmm. But some of your readers probably don't. Pandemic has nothing to do with severity. It has everything to do with something being widespread, in most of the world, if not all of the world, pretty much at the same time. I mean, it can roll from place to place, but it's pretty concentrated in time. It's causing at least some sickness. You don't call it a pandemic if it's totally benign. It's concentrated in time, it's widespread in space, and it's making a lot of people sick. But how sick has nothing to do with the definition of pandemic. Every infectious disease outbreak has a kind of a pyramid. And at the bottom of the pyramid are the people who are infected but asymptomatic. They're infected, but you know they have absolutely no symptoms. And a little bit higher up on the pyramid are people who are, you know, very mildly symptomatic. So mildly they don't know they're symptomatic. They go to work. You know, they look fine to their friends, but you know, after they get sicker, you know, and you ask them, you know, gee, in the days before you got really sick, did you have any symptoms? They remember that they, yeah, I had a cold, or, you know, I had a little bit of a flu-y feeling, but it wasn't much.
Right.
You know, and then higher up on the pyramid, you have people who have, you know, who know they don't feel very well, but they're still going about their business. And then higher up on the pyramid, you have people who are thinking about going to the doctor because they feel pretty crappy. And then you have people who go to the doctor, and then you have people who have to go to the hospital, and then you have people who go to the ICU, and then you have people who die.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, as you get higher and higher up that pyramid, there are fewer and fewer people. As you get higher and higher up that pyramid, usually the people are better able to transmit the disease because they're coughing more, they're sneezing more, they're emitting more of the virus. But in a different way, they're less able to transmit the disease because they're not going out. You know, they're feeling crappy. So, you know, eventually the only people they can transmit the disease to is people, you know, there's healthcare workers because they're in the hospital.
Right. That happened in SARS, you know, which made it very scary.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, so, you know, severe people, you know, severely ill people are transmission risks in hospitals. Mildly ill people are transmission risks, you know, in the world. And what, you know, what you worry about with the pandemic isn't the severe people. It's the mild people who are going to give it to other people. You know, so, you know, you wind up kind of knowing, you know, we don't know this yet, but you wind up with some sense of what percentage of all the people infected are at different points in the pyramid. How many infected people are asymptomatic and never get symptoms? How many, you know, get a little sick? How many get very sick and so forth? And eventually, you know, how many die? You know, so you eventually know the shape of the pyramid. We don't know the shape of the pyramid yet. The experts don't know the shape of the pyramid yet. They're doing all their work at the top of the pyramid.
Right. The top, I guess, is a lot more apparent than the bottom, which is pretty hard to know at this stage.
Exactly. And when the top is serious, you know, you're too busy to worry about the bottom. You're, mm-hmm. You know, there's nobody in China testing asymptomatic people to see if they're infected. They can't test all the seriously ill people they've got. You know, so yeah. They're not about to waste tests and test time on somebody who's asymptomatic. That's an interesting, important question. But, you know, when you're treating sick people, that doesn't, you know, that doesn't become a priority. So we have no idea in China, and we have no idea elsewhere how many mild people are infected. So we don't, you know, but we have every reason to think that most of the people who are infected have not come to anybody's attention.
Right.
Am I with you so far?
Oh, yes. In fact, this is all stuff I've been sort of thinking about over the last couple of days, and things that I think have gotten some press in things like Stat News, but not so much in the mainstream press. So it'll be good for me to weigh in on some of this.
So, you know, I mean, if what the media need to try to explain to people is it is spreading invisibly, and it, you know, all the experts are believing that, you know, unless something very surprising happens, it will continue spreading invisibly. And as it spreads more and more invisibly, the whatever percentage it is of people who catch it that get really sick will start to be visible. That happened in China, and it's starting to happen in other places, and it will happen in the places where it hasn't happened yet. you know, so that and you know, from if I were a journalist today, I would be, you know, in, you know, writing for an American audience, I would be writing about Singapore. Tell you why.
Okay.
Singapore has the combination of superb surveillance and superb transparency. And I, you know, it's hard to think of another country that has that that combination. So Singapore is doing a very good job of finding its early cases, and it's doing a very good job of telling its public much more about those cases than, let's say, the United States does.
Really? They're
It's all on their website. It's all online, so you can find it very easily. You can find a description of every individual. They don't name the individual, but every individual they find. When did they first experience symptoms? When did they first go to the doctor? You know, what are their symptoms now? You know, where have they been? What's their travel history? Have they been to China? What's their contact history? Have they had contact with anybody else we know to have had this disease? Do we have any idea who they caught it from? And where were they out and about? Did they attend a meeting? Did they go to the zoo? And they give you this information just in a couple of paragraphs on every individual that they have diagnosed and tested and found to have the coronavirus.
Wow.
And they're putting those pieces together, and they're telling their public, just in the last day or two, they're telling their public, we were finding this virus only in people who had traveled to China.
Right.
Then we were finding this virus in people who had known contact with people who had the virus. Then we were finding this virus in people who were in clusters that had kind of, they all got it from we don't know quite where, but they all got it at the same time in the same place. And now we're finding kind of miscellaneous people that are none of the above. And that's called community transmission. We're finding people who have never traveled to another place, so they got it here in Singapore. They haven't had any contact with anybody who is known to have had it. They haven't been to any of the places places that are known to be places where it was transmitted. Somewhere out and about, going about their daily lives, in a moment that they have, even in hindsight, no sense of where they got it, they got it. And that's called community transmission. And once you've got community transmission, you are about to enter a transition from focusing on trying to contain the virus to focusing on trying to ameliorate the situation, to manage the situation, to mitigate the situation. And Singapore is being totally candid I don't know if they're keeping secrets. I don't know what secrets they're keeping, but from what they're saying, they're being way more candid than anybody else in saying that's about to happen. You know, once you find cases that you can't link to any other cases, and Singapore hasn't found a lot of them yet, but it's telling its people, we will. And that none of this, Faye, as far as I know, is because Singapore is unique. Except it's unique in being able to find those cases quickly, and it's unique in being honest about what it found. But it's not unique in having people get sick. Singapore is, in my judgment, the right microcosm to be looking at. Singapore is us in a few weeks, probably.
Interesting. And do you think here in the U.S. we should be giving out that kind of information? That would be helpful?
Yes.
I mean, we get very little, about just the number of people, what cities they lived in, but and that they went to Wuhan, and one that they told us was the husband of a woman who'd been to Wuhan, but that's about it. I don't think there's been much more information than that. So what Singapore is doing is giving a lot more details about each case. Or do you think the U.S. may have more cases that haven't been made public?
I have no reason to think that the U.S. is finding cases and keeping them secret. I just think, you know, that we're a little behind Singapore in the spread of the disease, and we're a little bit behind Singapore in being good at finding it.
I mean,
other than contacts, the first time we will know that there is community transmission in the United States is when we have a cluster of unexplained pneumonias in the same place. How else are you going to find it? In some town there will be a whole, six or eight or 10 people who have serious enough illnesses that they're all showing up in the emergency room with very similar symptoms. And a doctor is going to say, I wonder if this is the first coronavirus cluster of this sort in the United States. And they'll be tested, and the answer will be yes.
Interesting.
And then we'll know it's happening here too. But to go back, because you shouldn't use me as a source of technical information. This is secondhand and thirdhand stuff. But what's firsthand is the question you asked about whether this is the sort of information that the public should be told now. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important. The idea that you should reassure people right up into the moment that you know that the problem is not on our doorstep but in our living room is a very peculiar idea. In general, you want to warn people about what's likely to come their way early enough that they can take precautions. And early enough that they, even if there are very few precautions to be taken, people need time to get used to it. People need time to think about it. Companies need time to plan on absenteeism, to plan on what they will do when, lots of people are too sick to come to work and lots of people are too scared to come to work. I can tell you that I have told all my children to go buy, or recommended, I don't tell them what to do, recommended that they buy a couple of months of any medication that they need now, because there are if this goes the way most experts think it's likely to go, there are going to be shortages. There's shortages because there are going to be supply chain problems, and there are going to be supply chain problems even if it's not pandemic because of the chaos in China. The more widely the chaos spreads, the more the supply chain problems get severe, and we're all going to want to be able to manage on our own during times when either the drugstore doesn't have the drug we need, or it's not a good time to go to the drugstore because it's scary out there. There are things people can actually do, like buying, a few months extra medications to prepare for what might happen. Not what's guaranteed to happen, but it's not a fanciful, conspiratorial possibility. It's a possibility that experts take very seriously. So there are things we can do, but the most important thing we can do is kind of gear up, get ready, get used to it, get through what people in risk communication like me call the adjustment reaction. The normal reaction when something scary first comes to your attention in a vivid way is you overreact. Very temporarily. You imagine that it's here already. You get a little uh, little paranoid. Maybe you get a little paralyzed. You know, things happen for a short term, and then you get used to it. And the goal is to get used to it before you're in the middle of the crisis. If it's going to be a crisis, you want people going into the crisis, you know, having prepared themselves emotionally and to whatever extent they can, having prepared themselves in the real world as well, but certainly having prepared themselves emotionally. So, yeah, I think now is the time not to tell people it's going to be catastrophic, because, you know, it probably isn't going to be catastrophic, but it's probably going to be disruptive. You know, there are probably going to be a lot of mild sicknesses, and therefore at the top of the pyramid, some severe sicknesses, and there is probably going to be a fair amount of disruption. None of that's guaranteed, but all of that is likely enough. And again, I'm not telling you it's likely because I know anything about it. I'm telling you it's likely because that's what most experts believe.
That's what the experts are saying, Do you think
The public needs to hear that and get used to that and get past this battle between the people who want to say, don't worry about it, worry about the flu instead, and the people who want to wear masks now when it's kind of useless. The last thing you want is the don't worry about it people are profoundly wrong, and the it's here already people are also wrong. It's not here already, and it's worth worrying about.
That's very sensible. Yes. Do you think that in China that can you comment on the risk communication there and the reaction there? How China has dealt with it, compared to SARS and just in general, compared to the way maybe they should have dealt with it?
Well, I mean, SARS was a very low bar and they cleared it.
Okay, you know? Yes. I mean, that's just a good way to put it.
You know, they did better than SARS, and that's not high praise.
I mean, because they really held back information on SARS and for a long time, longer time than with this.
Yes, yes. My sense is that, you know, what was going on this time was kind of bureaucratic inefficiency and self-delusion more than it was a conspiracy to keep secrets. You know, I mean, I have read, and, you know, this is secondhand, but I've read that, you know, officials in Wuhan looked at the list of things they were supposed to report up the hierarchy, and strange unknown disease wasn't on the list. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of diseases on the list, but strange unknown disease wasn't on the list, and it was a time when very major political, you know, national meetings were happening, and they didn't want to shake the tree unless there was something in writing that said, under these circumstances, you're supposed to shake the tree, and there wasn't. So this was a hidebound bureaucracy and a fear of passing bad news up the line when you hadn't been ordered to pass this particular category of bad news up the line. So clearly early on they made some very serious mistakes in internal communication. Once they decided that it was a big deal. You know, well, I should say the other error, which is an extremely common error, is early, you know, as they began to say, yes, we've got a problem, they underestimated the size of the problem. They overestimated the likelihood that they could solve it. They interpreted everything that was unknown in a reassuring direction. So it was like no evidence yet of person-to-person transmission, got interpreted as it can't be transmitted person to person. No evidence yet of community transmission got interpreted as there's no community they optimistically interpreted what they knew and didn't decide that things were worse than they had thought until the evidence was overwhelming that things were worse than they had thought. And so they were slow. That all of that is normal and human, but also culpable. And you know, as I say, they did a better job than they did with SARS, but not as good a job as one would have hoped. But you know, the stunning thing, and then perhaps the more important thing, is they have made efforts to contain the disease that are more ambitious and more stringent than anyone has ever attempted. I mean, you know, locking down on cities of 11 million here and 6 million there, and you know, locking down city after city after city. Nobody's done that.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, there was no way you could do that in a democracy. You know, I mean, you have to be China, not the United States, to be able to do that. Nobody's done it. It's very clear that to some extent they were trying to lock the barn after lock the barn door after the horses have escaped.
Yeah.
But it's also true that unlike that metaphor, there were still horses escaping, and locking the barn door after some horses have escaped is not entirely useless.
Right.
You can't quite trust WHO's praise for China because WHO is praising China for tactical reasons. You know, WHO says China's been wonderful because it wants to keep the communication as open as possible between it and China. So you know, it's kind of WHO at one point praised North Korea for doing a good job against obesity when people were starving.
Did they really? You know, yeah. Oh my God, I didn't know that.
So you can't take literally WHO's praise for China, but nonetheless, you know, it is probably true that they bought us all some time. That China bought us time by shutting down cities in the same way that, you know, the U.S. Administration bought some time by shutting down travel. None of that is going, you know, I mean, if you think of containment as dichotomous, either it's perfect or it's worthless. You know, if you have to choose between perfect and worthless, the answer is worthless. But of course, you shouldn't choose between perfect and worthless. All containment strategies are porous to one extent or another, and for all containment strategies, you know, whether you're talking about the common ones like contact tracing or the much more controversial ones like travel restrictions and quarantines. They all do some good. They are all better at slowing the spread of a disease than stopping it. You know, it's very hard to stop it, but slowing it isn't unimportant. Slowing it has real benefits. The communication problem is if you talk about containment as if you were stopping the disease, then when you fail to stop the disease, people are going to understandably conclude that that was a stupid thing to do and you shouldn't have done it. And they're going to be shocked and they're going to be upset. The time to tell people now that, you know, these various containment strategies, they have advantages and they have disadvantages. They have upsides and downsides, and it's a judgment call which is bigger. Excuse me. You know, it's a judgment call which is bigger, the upsides or the downsides. But the thing you know for sure is the upsides are not perfect. So whether you're talking about travel restrictions, you know, your travel bans, which are very controversial, or you're talking about, you know, identifying the contacts of a patient and monitoring those contacts, which is very conventional, those are all aimed at the same thing, slowing, not stopping the spread of the disease. And if you make them, if you let the public think they're aimed at stopping the spread of the disease, you're setting yourself up to have to come back and say, well, that didn't work.
Yeah, that's. I think that's a, and, you know, it's a great point. Yeah, that, that people tend to be thinking, you know, in terms of dichotomies here.
Yeah, and reporters are writing in terms of dichotomies. You know, the purpose of slowing the spread of the disease is to buy. The main purpose is to buy time. The other main purpose is to flatten the curve, and that, you know, that matters. You know, if the disease spreads slowly, you have less disruption than if the disease spreads fast. Even if you assume that in the end, 63% of the public will get it, you know, and I've made the number
right.
up. But, you know, I mean, even if you're going to have exactly the same outcome, you know, exactly the same number of infected people, having them infected over a year is way less disruptive than having them all infected in the same month.
Yes.
You know, because if they're all infected in the same month, you get hospital overcrowding, you get you run out of essential equipment and essential supplies, you have much more serious absenteeism problems, you know, you have to shut down the schools because too many teachers are sick, and, you know, all kinds of horrible things happen if it's very intense. And if you can spread it out, And containment helps to spread it out, you know, that helps. It doesn't make it go away. It just makes it less awful.
That makes a lot of sense. It seems like that you're right, that they have done us a favor in slowing things down and giving people some chance to prepare here.
Just to rub it in, they're giving us a chance to prepare. One of the ways we need to prepare is to have the public get used to the idea, and we're pissing that time away by not giving people coherent understanding of what's likely coming.
And you think, so in other words, the CDC press conferences haven't been, they haven't been giving people enough information about at least the experts' best guesses?
You know, I wouldn't go quite that far. They give you enough information that if you are listening knowledgeably to the entire news conference, to the entire presser, you learn what you need to know. But the emphasis isn't there. You know, I have yet to see a CDC, and I haven't watched them all, but I'm not aware of any of the CDC news conferences that felt like warnings to the American public that we're in for a hard ride. You know, they all felt, even though the information was there, I mean, you can find Nancy Messonnier saying, you know, it might go pandemic. You can find Fauci, you know, at NIH, you know, saying it's probably going to be a pandemic. You can't find anybody, you know, that's too strong. You can't find very many examples of high-ranking government officials saying in highly visible public venues, this looks likely to be disruptive to us, and we need to get ready.
And what are
you
the
know,
main
now,
things?
Now, if
yeah.
you read, if you let me make an additional point.
Okay.
If you read the trade journals in any field, those messages are there. You read the trade journals in hospital administration, they're talking about getting ready for a very hard time. If you read the trade journals in transportation, they're talking about getting ready for a very hard time. If you read the trade journals in virtually any field, they are talking about the coronavirus as something that looks likely to be a major problem for our field. But if you read the mass media, you read the stuff that's for the general public, it's like China's in trouble and we, you know, we've gone from 11 cases to 13 cases and, you know, that's no big deal.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's that. I think that that is a very important point. That it seems like right, our number of cases are so small right now that we know of, but that's the that pyramid that we're talking about.
Well, it's that, and it's doubling time. You know the old story of the pasha that makes a deal with somebody that says, all right, I'm going to give you one grain of rice on the first square of the checkerboard and two grains on the second square and four grains on the third square and so on. 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, et cetera. And, you know, the pasha makes the deal without realizing that he's going to have no rice left. Because by the time you get to 64 doublings and you finish the checkerboard, you have an incredible amount of rice.
Yeah, yes. Maybe more than there actually exists. And,
Exactly. And people don't understand that, and nobody's explaining it to them. That you know, if you have 5 or 6 undiscovered, unisolated cases, and it's spreading at whatever rate it's spreading at. You know, 5 becomes 10 and 10 becomes 20 and 20 becomes 40. And maybe it takes 4 days for each of those. Don't use me the best estimate of that. But if it takes 4 days to double and there are now 10 cases we don't know about that are mild and are walking around, then in 4 days there will be 20, and in 8 days there will be 40, and in 60 days there will be 80, and pretty soon there will be thousands, and then there will be hundreds of thousands, and then we'll know about it because the tip of the pyramid will be visible.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. I mean, people have talked about exponential spread, but I don't think that what that means has been emphasized enough. That's what's likely to happen. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
You okay?
I think one of the mantras of the World Health Organization is facts, not fear.
Okay.
And it's like those are not opposites. Facts, not fear, is a very weird way to set things up. I mean, imagine saying that about vaccination. Imagine saying that about crossing the street to your 2-year-old. Fear, I mean, it's certainly true that excesses of fear are harmful. Excesses of fear, you know, make you do unwise things. They make you reallocate resources in undesirable ways. At very high levels, fear can be paralyzing. There's no question that extremely high fear is harmful. There's also no question that other than extremely high fear, fear is a tool. Fear is a motive to get ready. Fear is mobilizing. It's only extremely high fear that's immobilizing. What sense can you make of the mantra facts, not fear, when the facts are fearful? Yes, we want to give people the facts, but we want to give people the facts in a vivid enough way that they understand what the experts already understand, that this looks bad. I have lived through and worked on a number of pandemics and possible pandemics, you know, and it's worth looking at some comparisons. Okay, are you with me?
Uh-huh. Okay.
H5N1 bird flu looked enormously more deadly than this does.
Yes.
You know, I mean, a very high percentage of people who caught it died. And, you know, but it was not very good at communicating human to human. It was much more a zoonotic disease than it was a pandemic disease. People got it from animals, and they had a hard time giving it to each other. It wasn't easy to get it from animals. I mean, it was mostly a disease from animal to animal, sometimes from animal to human, and occasionally from human to human. And there was fear for a while that it looked like it was getting more skillful at transmitting human to human. And if that happened, you know, that looked like it could be, you know, the worst catastrophe in recorded history. It looked for a couple of years like, you know, it could be worse than the 1918 flu pandemic. Mm-hmm. This is not that, you know. The bad news is we know this transmits easily in a way that H5N1 didn't. And the good news is we don't know the fatality rate, but we know it's way, 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 way lower than it was for H5N1. I was part of the effort to get people to get ready for H5N1, which never came. Now I'm trying to help people get ready for the coronavirus, and I think it's going to come, but it isn't going to be H5N1. It's going to be significantly less disastrous than that.
You mean that, right, okay?
Then that would have been, yes, exactly. Yeah, on the other extreme was swine flu in 2009. And when swine flu was first discovered, and it's perhaps worth reminding your readers that it didn't originate in China. It originated in Mexico and the United States.
Right.
Opinions differ about who came first, whether we got it from Mexico or they got it from us. In the early days of swine flu, it looked pretty severe. Not like H5N1 certainly, but it looked like it was more severe than we liked to think. But it very quickly became clear that it was genuinely pandemic, it was genuinely easily transmitted, it was going to go worldwide, but it was quite mild. And WHO, and once again, I was part of trying to warn people about swine flu in the very early days, and then we very quickly discovered that it was pretty mild, and it was hard to say. And WHO got into a lot of trouble because they were reluctant, having sounded the alarm, they were reluctant to say, well, pandemic, yes, but such a mild pandemic that H5N1, no, I'm sorry, not H5N1, that the swine flu saved lives. Did you know that?
No. How?
The swine flu, the strain of the pandemic strain replaced a more dangerous strain.
Oh.
And as a result, the strain of H1N1 that had been circulating was deadlier than the pandemic strain that outcompeted it.
Wow.
So the earlier H1N1 strain disappeared. It had been a kind of a standard of seasonal flu. It disappeared. It was replaced by this new H1N1, which became the new seasonal flu after the pandemic was over. And as a result, seasonal flu death declined.
Isn't that interesting? I'm going to look that up now. That's fascinating.
That you want a best case scenario. That's a pandemic that saved lives.
Wow. That is really something. Yeah. So those are kind of our past cases that we can learn from. What are...
More than that, those are bookends. Those are bookends.
Oh, okay.
You know, what H5N1 might have been is worse than anybody thinks this is going to be. What swine flu turned out to be is better than anybody thinks this is going to be.
And
it's going to be somewhere in the middle between those bookends.
And so what are you talking about sort of helping people prepare? So what are the things now that we still have a little bit of time? What are the most important things people can do to prepare?
Well, I continue to think that the single most important thing to do to prepare is get used to the idea, is get past the adjustment reaction, you know, get past being in denial and refusing to take it seriously, which is a problem, or being hysterical and taking it, you know, more seriously than it deserves so far, which is a problem. Getting through the adjustment reaction and out the other side into the new normal where this is part of our lives is the single, in my judgment, the single most important thing for people to do. But then there are practical things people can do now, and there are certainly practical things organizations can do now. A lot of it has to do with planning. As community transmission becomes more common, assuming that happens, the emphasis of governments and of organizations moves from containment to mitigation. You stop trying to stop it. You even stop, You stop trying to stop it, and you start trying to mitigate it, or you focus more on mitigating it. And so one of the main things you do that we can start getting ready for now, in case we're going to need it, is social distancing. So, school closings become more likely. Mass events tend to be canceled. People get encouraged to telecommute rather than go to work. Business continuity becomes a real issue. One of the things businesses should be doing as they, or any organization should be doing as it gets ready for a pandemic that, even if it kills relatively few people, is likely to sicken a lot of people condensed into a short period of time, is cross-training. You start thinking, okay, who do we have in our organization that if they're sick for a week, we're really hobbled? And who else can we train so that they can take on that person's job if that person is sick? Doing a lot of cross-training now so that organizations are more resilient when illness is more common for a while is a very concrete thing that organizations can do. Individuals can start planning, what am I going to do if my kids have to stay home? And that's two different plans. What do I do if I have a sick kid? Or three different plans. What do I do if I have a sick kid? What do I do if I'm sick? What do I do if the schools are closed? The time to start figuring those things out, kind of now.
Yes. Yes. Well, there have been a lot of articles of sort of very sort of pessimistic ones saying, oh, well, our country was not prepared for this, as if we've sort of missed some window of opportunity to be prepared. And I was thinking back to an earlier conversation you and I had about sort of people having having an overwhelming number of things to be prepared for when nothing's going on.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that we get both halves of this wrong. That the idea that you should prepare for X when X isn't on the horizon. You should spend a lot of money getting ready for something that you have no idea when it'll happen or if it'll happen and no evidence that it's coming is debatable. How much money do you want to spend preparing for an asteroid hit?
Yes.
How much money do you want to spend preparing for when artificial intelligence tries to conquer humanity? How much money do you want to spend preparing for an earthquake in New York City? You can make a very long list of hazards that you might spend a lot of money preparing for. And it's easy in hindsight. Once something is on the horizon, it's very straightforward to say we should have prepared more earlier for this.
Yes.
But that's hindsight bias. You know,
right.
We didn't know it was this that we had to prepare for. We had a list of 1,000 thises. And if you're saying we should have prepared for this, do you think we should have prepared for the other 999? Or do you think we should have known it was going to be this? I think the case for, obviously some kinds of all-hazard preparedness make sense. But the sense that you can prepare for everything as if it were on the horizon when it isn't seems to me excessive. Okay, that's the first half. Okay, and then paradoxically, the second half is when it's on the horizon, suddenly they stop telling you to prepare.
Yeah.
Which is bass ackwards. I don't know that we should have prepared for the coronavirus before there was a coronavirus, but we sure as hell should prepare for it now.
Yes. I'm just taking some notes here. That's the best quote. But tell me about what you think about the... Is there a risk communication failure in the proliferation of conspiracy theories? We seem to have a lot of them floating around, so you kind of have to go look for them on websites or social media.
Yeah, you know, I mean, let me say a couple of things about that. One is, you know, the vast majority of outlier opinions always turn out false. You know, every once in a while, an outlier opinion turns out true. The existence of outlier opinions is both inevitable and healthy. The tendency of the society to focus too much on outlier opinions is neither inevitable nor healthy, and that's unfortunate, but I don't know what to do about it. In other words, if you take one particular so-called conspiracy theory that the coronavirus was bioengineered, bioengineered in Canada, bioengineered in the U.S., bioengineered in China, you know, bioengineered to be particularly deadly to Chinese people, you know, because, you know, it's a bio war against Asia. I mean, there are all kinds of variants of this, but, you know, it all starts with the idea that this is a human-made bioengineered virus.
Right. Yes. Okay.
That theory is probably false. Okay. The fact that theory is being advanced by significant, you know, well, I won't say so. The fact that theory is being advanced and that some people are looking for evidence that it's true and other people are looking to rebut that evidence and show that it's false, I think that's very healthy. I wouldn't want to live in a society in which nobody was considering that possibility because it might be true. You know, I assume that, you know, somewhere in the government, there are still people checking it to, you know, and then rechecking it and then double rechecking it because, you know, it's really important to know if it's true. So the fact that there are conspiracy theories is, in my judgment, or, you know, that are conspiracy theory is kind of a loaded term. The fact that there are outlier opinions that are exceedingly unlikely to be true, and that those opinions don't become impossible to find, I think is healthy. I think it's good that you can find those outlier opinions and that people in authority can find them and check them and rebut them if they're rebuttable and confirm them if they're confirmable and, take them seriously. Even if they're probably false. I mean, one of the things that risk communication people tell their clients, that I have often told clients, is don't trash a theory that's probably false, but you haven't disproved it conclusively. you know, you want to communicate that it's probably false, and you want to communicate, but you don't want to communicate that in a way that trashes it. So, you know, you say, as Julie Gerberding said about SARS at one point. Julie Gerberding was then, I don't know if she was yet head of the CDC. She became head of the CDC, yeah. But I think she was then head of the infectious disease branch. And there was a story, I think, in USA Today that said that SARS is from outer space. Uh-huh. And Miriam Falco, asked Dr. Gerberding at a press conference, well, what do you think about this hypothesis that SARS is from outer space? And she said, this isn't the direct quote, but it's close. She said, you know, we have no evidence that SARS is from outer space, but we're keeping an open mind. Which is way better to say than what kind of conspiracy theorist are you?
Yeah. That's so interesting.
I don't think conspiracy theories are a problem. I think fighting about whether conspiracy theories are a problem is a problem. We ought to take conspiracy theories in stride. As, you know, yes, you know, there's always a spectrum of opinion, including some that are way out on the edges. And it's healthy to have edges. And it's healthy to take the edges seriously. And it's healthy to remember that the edges are almost always, but not always, wrong.
I really like that. I had not thought about it that way, but it makes perfect sense to, and I think her answer was the right answer, which it also sort of keeps people from becoming too paranoid that there's a cover up when you say, well, we're not going to just dismiss that out of hand, but we don't think it's likely.
I think that's the right answer. And then when you get better evidence, when you have pretty conclusive evidence that it's false, you should tell people you have pretty conclusive evidence that it's false, but still respectful. This was worth investigating. We're grateful to the people who raised it for making sure it got investigated, and it's been investigated. And we're now pretty, very confident that it's false. And if they want to keep looking into it, God bless, because, we've been wrong before. But we're moving on.